WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
In the introduction to his new collection of profiles, Lawrence Weschler explains the wide range of his subjects. He says he's concerned with people that were just moseying down the street one day, minding their own business, when suddenly, almost spontaneously, they became obsessed, intensely focused, and intensely alive. The result is almost always a transformation that alters the course of a life. One profile is about an English teacher from India who stumbles upon the work of an unknown and reclusive abstract expressionist painter, and then devotes his life to bringing that painter attention and success. Another profile focuses on an underground cartoonist whose comic book story of how his father survived the Holocaust becomes a bestseller. The collection is titled Chapinsky's Karma, Boggs, Bill, and Other True Tales. Four of the six profiles first appeared in the New Yorker magazine, where Lawrence Weschler is a staff writer. I asked Weschler about the thread running through his profiles.
What interests me most is the ordinary taking flight, the everyday becoming problematic and either passionate or peculiar, I guess. And it's just because it's not just with profiles. I realize that about my political writing as well. What I'm most interested in is that moment when somebody who was just moseying along down the street catches fire and becomes passionate about something.
One of your pieces is about a man from India named Akamal Ramachandar. And he thought that it was his karma to gain recognition for a 60-year-old abstract expressionist painter from America who had previously gone totally unrecognized. His name, the painter's name, was Harold Chapinsky. Uh-huh. Now, how did this guy find you? Why did he find you?
He is the kind of, once he caught fire with that passion, he's a schemer. He's a he manages to, anything that can be put into his quest gets drawn into the quest. So he happened to have just been in Poland, and he saw a book of mine at a bookstore in the United States. He'd seen that I'd written about Poland, and on the back it revealed that I had also written about art. And so he immediately assumed that I would be that it was my karma to be discovered by him and as part of his discovering of Chapinsky. So he just called me up out of nowhere in the middle of the night and arranged an appointment. Originally, he was just going to talk. He said he just wanted to talk to me about Poland, and we talked about that for a while. And then suddenly he just started this weird tale that he'd discovered this artist and that I really had to go see the work of this artist and that this was the greatest artist who had never had a show before in his life. He was 60 years old. He lived in a garret. I had to go see this guy's work, and I just... Akamal was a fairly intense fellow, and I kind of had a tendency to just let it slide. But then over the next several weeks, I began getting these phone calls from all over Europe. He was in London, he was in Amsterdam, he was in Cologne, and each time he was upping the ante with tales about what museum officials and various things were thinking about Chapinsky, and culminating with telling me that he'd gotten a one-man show for him, and that the Tate was fascinated, and that British television was going to do an hour-long documentary, and I didn't believe any of it. I thought that Akamal was this was all some elaborate fantastification on his part. And then suddenly one day he calls and he says, "I'm back in New York with the British television crew. We're filming it. You have to come right now." And everything he had related was in fact true. He had done all these things. And basically I could believe it in the sense of the kind of pigheadedness with which he'd pursued me. He had inflicted on everybody else in the story, and we were all drawn together in this opera of his.
You're not afraid to put yourself in the stories that you write. When you're writing about someone, you're usually there in the story responding to what it is that they do.
Uh-huh.
Taking them out to lunch or going with them to a show or watching them
right.
work or whatever.
Right.
Did you ever have trouble with that at all? Did you ever think that you were supposed to be the fly on the wall and invisible in the story itself?
On the contrary, I find fly on the wall journalism extremely difficult to read.
Mm-hmm.
There is this crazy fiction of objective reporting, and it's entirely a fiction. I mean, I think journalism should aspire to a kind of transparency, and I bend over backwards to make sure that the reader understands that this was happening among a group of individuals, that the writer was one of those individuals, that they reading it are one of those individuals, and that we are all responsible for the kinds of things we say. I much prefer reading writing that has that kind of quality.
You know, the pieces of yours that are in your new book are all profile pieces that were printed in the New Yorker magazine. Is there a New Yorker profile style that you had to learn before you started writing these pieces?
I certainly didn't go about learning it. I think I probably was influenced by the New Yorker. I know that, for example, the very first thing I ever wrote, which was a first long piece, which was a profile of Robert Irwin, the California artist. I had written it, you know, just in my room. I certainly wasn't writing for the New Yorker or anything. And yet when it came back in New Yorker galleys a year after I'd originally written it, I was amazed. Dude, this really reads like a New Yorker piece. And I think that has to do with
the typesetting.
Partly with the type. I think it is, by the way, the typesetting. I think you could take the phone book and put it in the in New Yorker typeface and it might read like a New Yorker piece. But I think it also, there's no question that John McPhee, Joseph Mitchell, some of the others were great influences on my writing as I was becoming a writer.
Have you ever started a piece on someone and they were really excited you were going to write about them, and then you realized that it wasn't really a piece and you had to bail out regrets?
Oh, yeah.
What's that like? It must really hurt the person who you're abandoning.
It's, I mean, particularly because of the intensity of co-presence that we enjoy for a period. I mean, you know, you spend weeks and weeks with someone,
mm-hmm.
And you really are... you're getting very, very much inside the middle of their lives. And sometimes it is precisely because of there's something out of key in the middle of their lives. There's a hollow spot you weren't expecting to find. And I'm not, you know, I'm not interested in writing exposés of people's hollow spots. I mean, the world is such a extravagant festival. I mean, I think you can pretty much get by in your career writing celebrations or celebratory pieces and not. I mean, I think it's in my political writing, I am very happy to take on injustices and so forth and so on. But if somebody's inviting you into their lives for 4 or 5 weeks, you have no good faith business revealing a kind of hollowness at the end of it. And if you find that, it's difficult.
So what do you tell someone if you've decided to not do a piece on
them? Well, that's the advantage of working for the New Yorker. You say, oh, the New Yorker is so mysterious. I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm working on it. I don't know what's going on. And often, by the way, as things happen, I very often will keep track of people, and sometimes my anxieties are dissipated. You know, things that bother me, they seem to work out, and then I can get back to it.
In your writing, you have alternated between politics, specifically writing mostly about Poland, and the art world, artists, the art marketplace. It's interesting to me that you've managed to keep both in your life, art and politics, and to keep them pretty well in balance. It's obviously important to you to not give up one for the other.
You know, I mean, my hope is and my great luck working at the New Yorker is that I may not have to give up anything. You know, I try to keep as wide open as possible, although I keep returning in all the work to the same basic themes, whether it's done as a comedy or as a political piece, where more often than not it's done as a tragedy. I'm trying to write about people who suddenly take charge of their lives in some way, and of how difficult that is, and how and of all the forces that mitigate against that.
I guess what I'd like to know too, you seem to find it very important to balance in your life politics and art and ideas. You know, to uh-huh. acknowledge the importance of political struggle and social change, and at the same time acknowledge the importance of sensuality and aesthetics and ideas, of more abstract uh-huh. things.
I mean, I don't think I think that any politics that gets deracinated from the sensual becomes a withered politics. And conversely, any art that tries to exist as if the political wasn't real, in turn also gets deracinated. And they do need to inform and nourish each other.
Okay, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Lawrence Weschler's collection of profiles, Shapinsky's Karma, Boggs, Bill, and Other True Tales, is published by North Point Press. This is Fresh Air.